Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. It's an Easter lockdown special featuring me, Mike Calvin, Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst, and Seb Stafford-Bloor from Football 365. Go on, admit it. Everyone is a sucker for good transfer rumours. They sell newspapers, pile on the clicks, and boost ratings. But are they in keeping with the spirit of what will be a new age in football? Will the transfer system even survive the inevitable financial correction? What do you think, Seb?
Oh, I don't know, Mike. I mean, actually, I really liked a suggestion Adrian made a couple of episodes ago where if a club have opted to use the furloughing scheme, then they're actually prohibited from making summer transfers. But I wonder more about the appetite for transfers than I do about the mechanic, because sort of when we emerge from this, the game will grind back into life, but a lot of people will still be facing a lot of hardship, and no doubt sort of all the measures which have been introduced to protect the population during these last few months, there'll be a bill in the post for that. There'll be a tax implication, there'll be a lifestyle implication. So whether football can really carry on sort of spending decadently and throwing money at players kind of in a kind of endless pursuit of ambition, I don't know. It's almost a taste thing, isn't it, Mike?
Yeah, it certainly is. Do you think that, you know, on the practical side, Uli Hoeneß said a week or so ago that he couldn't foresee a 100 million euro or pound transfer in the future. He just thinks the finances won't add up. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't really, if I'm being honest. I think that at the moment, football doesn't matter. Football transfers seem completely irrelevant. But we will, I'm sure, return to normality. And once football's back, I think we'll fall back into it quite nicely. And players will still want to further their careers. Clubs will still have ambition to win trophies. But in fact, individuals within clubs, players, managers, board members, have had a little bit of thinking time. Their appetite for the game might be even stronger than it was before. I agree that it doesn't feel right at the moment. And I also agree that spending extortionate amounts of money on players may be more difficult in the financial climate that's to come. That much is obvious. But football will find a way, I'm sure, to carry on doing business. And look, we kind of need the football economy to get back up and running, don't we? To feel normality again and to get the money back into football clubs that will have struggled in the interim period. What we will see, in my opinion, looking into the crystal ball, is a few vultures circling the clubs that they perceive as weak. Clubs that have maybe been hit hardest by the economic impact of coronavirus. When they've got good players available, I can see the big boys flexing their muscles pretty early doors to cash in and make the most of it. It seems distasteful at the moment, but I'm convinced it will happen.
Yeah, I suppose if we are going to go into that 100 million plus territory, Seb, what type of player will basically fill that void? And I'm thinking, would it be a younger player, a potential marquee player? So I'm thinking about people like Jadon Sancho, Kylian Mbappe, those type of players?
Yeah, definitely, Mike, because I think that's the trend in the market now. I mean, the problem with the benefit of investing in a young player. So I think probably a good example is someone like Yao Felix. You can suffer an initially, you know, what looks like a bad return on your investment. Yao Felix hasn't had a particularly good season at Atletico Madrid. He remains awesomely talented. But because the potential remains latent, his value retains itself. So in a way, there's less risk in spending large on a player like that. I don't see any problem in spending that amount of money on a Jadon Sancho type. He's obviously extremely talented and well worth his fee. But I think what's interesting is that even someone like Harry Kane, who is really could be considered to be in his prime, he's 27 years old. I know he's got an injury history, but people are already saying, well, no, you can't spend £150 million on him. He's the England captain. He's a proven goal scorer. And yet that still makes sense because you think, well, this is, if you're going to be spending fees like that, then financial fair play mandates that you must have a resale value somewhere, unless you're an awesomely powerful commercial entity, which, you know, most clubs are not. There are very, very few clubs who fit into that category. So I think that kind of money is going to be reserved for the players under 23 going forward. And for anybody else, it's going to be very hard to meet valuations or get them out of contracts or meet release fees.
Yeah, Mike, I think that what we might see is unfortunately clubs sort of running themselves into even more debt. That's the problem, because they, once the juices get flowing and the competitiveness comes back, I don't see them wanting to stand still. And this is where financial fair play would come in, which is obviously kind of, well, it's failed to a large degree, hasn't it, financial fair play. I think what we might have to see UEFA do here, or FIFA, whoever's going to call it, is maybe turn it back into more of the model that we see with the lower league clubs in England, whereby if you can't afford to run up a certain amount of debt before spending X amount of money, that would be the way forward. I think the whole turnover business has to be shelved, for percentage of turnover has to be shelved for the time being, because everybody will be all over the place financially. So yeah, we will get there. I'm convinced of it, because trophies will still be up for grabs. Players will still be in their prime. Harry Kane will still want to go out there and make the most of his individual career. I don't think that what's happening right now, the crisis, will prevent him moving on if that's what he wants to do.
But, you know, Age, you know players better than most. Do you think that some will seek to exploit the situation to their own end?
Yeah,
so,
of
for
course.
Instance, do you think we'll see an increasing number of players running down their contracts?
Yeah, I do. I also think contracts will be cancelled left, right and centre. I think there'll be a lot of free transfers flying all over the place for players that maybe wouldn't have been granted free transfers before. Clubs will need to trim wage bills, and they'll say, look, we're not going to ask a fee for you on this occasion. We need to get you off the books. Off you go. And of course, when that happens, those free transfer players will then quite understandably look to command high-ish salaries elsewhere because there's no fee. I think that will change. I think that would be the big change. A lot more players will go for free than we see right now. And absolutely players, and more importantly, really, agents who, and no one feels sorry for agents at the moment, but agents aren't making money the same as the rest of us. They will be looking to make up for shortfalls too, and they will be busier, I'm sure, than ever in trying to manufacture movement between clubs and players. So yeah, I actually think the activity could go up fairly rapidly once those windows are open.
Yeah, I can foresee a time where agents will focus most of their attention on the younger element. You know, I go to academy games and you see now more and more agents there trying to get the players at the start of the process, for instance. Is that something you could see happening, Seb?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think it's probably been happening since the agent market became deregulated, because for a new agent or someone that wants to exist in the marketplace without a reputation, that's really got to be the only way into the industry. That being said, it worries me because I don't like agents being attached to young players when they have an agenda to progress themselves, when they have a financial need. I fully accept that the cliche that most of us have drawn about agents over the years is a bit too generalized. But at the same time, it's not as if we're lacking instances in which young careers are being hijacked or directed in a certain way to suit the financial aims of a representative. And I'm strictly against anything that involves not doing whatever is in the best interests of the player. So it worries me. I completely agree it will be a trend. And also with what we said about free transfers, the role of the agent is going to be really, really important over the next few months, probably even over the next few years. And that's not a particularly comforting thought.
No. What do we think should happen with the in regards to the window, boys? Because I can see this season ending potentially in the autumn. Let's say, none of us know, of course, but let's say it ends towards the back end of September, and then they have a 2-week break, and then we kick off again with 2021. That's not long enough, is it, to have a window open? What do we think? I'm thinking open the window from the moment this current season ends, and maybe just leave it open until the new year or something like that, and just have the one window in the season just to allow the clubs to recalibrate. I don't know.
FIFA were talking earlier last week about permitting a new transfer window between the old and the new seasons. But as you say, Aid, that's probably not going to be long enough, is it? I would just basically probably say, well, look, let's go the cycle of the next season. So you know, just keep the window open as it used to be without basically not have a window. Just have an open house for, say, however long that season would be, 6 months, 8 months, whatever
well,
it would be.
At least the first half of the season. We always had that deadline, and I think it's important to keep that deadline because I don't think you can have the window open at the business end of the season. But yeah, I do agree for the bulk of the following season.
You know, it's going to be important. I mean, I know it's essential that clubs are able to recruit, but I think it's going to be more important that some clubs are able to sell. And cover shortfalls with, you know, not only getting players' contracts off their books, but covering losses with one or two big sales possibly. And I think, given how fluid the situation is going to be, you've got to have the flexibility of a non-window, like Mike described. Just say, look, it's open and you now have the utility to do whatever you have to do to secure your financial future. I think that's essential.
Yeah, that's what I meant with the vulture circling.
Yeah.
The clubs that need the money will sell players.
And clubs will try and get rid of big contracts, won't they? You know, if you take as a case in point, actually proven over the last sort of year or so, someone like Gareth Bale, I noticed he'd been linked in almost like a package with James Rodriguez, going to Everton. As it stands, I can't see any English club being able to pick up the sort of wages that a Gareth Bale is earning at Real Madrid.
No chance. I mean, when I saw that story, I thought, well, how on earth are they going to afford him? You know, but that's the reason he's still at Real Madrid. It's that no one really on the planet can afford Gareth Bale. And those that can aren't in desperate need for him. So yeah, he really is stuck. I think Gareth will never have a contract as lucrative as the one that he's on right now. But look, you know, if he takes the wage cut, it happens to all of us. Look, we can't all continue to go on an upward trajectory, can we, in terms of our earnings? We all want to, but sooner or later you have to think, right, okay, maybe that was my peak earning potential and now I'll accept much lower. And look, when he does make that move, a team will get a heck of a good player, because I still rate him so highly, Gareth Bale. He'll be brilliant for somebody, but probably on half the money.
Yeah, I could see him ending up at somewhere like Bayern Munich, actually. And, you know, speaking of Bayern, you've got, you know, the situation now where Hansi Flick has actually signed his managerial contract till 2023. I know we're in a province of ifs, buts and maybes, Seb, but as things stand, would you make Bayern favourites if and when the Champions League resumes?
Yeah, it's very tempting, isn't it? Because I mean, with Liverpool now out, I mean, I still, even though they are out, I still see them as the best team in Europe. Now, with them out of the competition, it's a bit of a free-for-all, and Bayern look awfully strong. And I have to say that I think it's not a question of them being obviously better than every other side. It's more that every other side is more obviously flawed. I know it's a bit of a contrarian's approach and a perspective on it, but there's more stability there. A lot of other clubs are in periods of great flux, betwixt and between eras, or in such a state as a result of what we're experiencing now that it becomes very difficult to forecast their route forward. I like what Bayern are doing though, Mike, because I presume the logic there is to keep Flick in situ until 2023, at which point Julian Nagelsmann has completed his time at RB Leipzig and then he moves to the club. You can see the continuity building there, and I really like that as a strategy, because obviously the players are reacting to what's there at the moment. That's been a good solution. And then Nagelsmann, it's one of the worst kept secrets in European football, isn't it, that he will eventually go there. So it makes a lot of sense, and I like where they're headed.
Mm. You a fan? Are you?
But yeah, very much so. Yeah, I think Hansi Flick has done a brilliant job. Obviously, he learned a lot working with Jurgen Löw with the national team all those years. I think a number of things he's done that are worthy of note. I think going back to Thomas Müller, putting his arm around him and making him a fixture in the 11 was a smart move. He's not done as a top flight player. Thomas Müller, he's been sensational. I mean, they are a very good team. I mean, you've still got Lewandowski doing the business. And you've got Müller, Coman and Gnabry off them. You've got a midfield unit that's in their prime, Thiago and Kimmich. You've got Alaba, who I've always loved. And also Boateng. I think Boateng is probably the weak link, actually. Definitely past his best. And you know, Davis, Alphonso Davis. Wow. What a lightning bolt of a fullback he is. So, yeah, I find it hard to find too many faults with Bayern. And yeah, I think that I would personally, judged on what I've seen of them in the Champions League, I don't watch them every week in the Bundesliga, but based on what I've seen of them in the Champions League, I think they will make the final. I really do.
Yeah. Speaking of management and German football, let's get into our next batch of managerial assessments, if we could. As you remember, we're judging the Premier League managers, all 20 of them, on their status as leaders and tacticians and coaches and communicators. And obviously there has to be an element of their overall body of work in this assessment. I'd like to start this time around with another German manager, Daniel Farker at Norwich, a team which probably has been punished for its naivety. Lovely to watch, I think, a terrifically well-run football club. And in Stu Weber, I think is a prototypical sporting director who I think will probably end up at a massive club and do something pretty significant. Seb, how does Farker fit in to the Norwich model, do you think?
Well, he's a component, isn't he, Mike? I mean, he was brought to the club to fulfill a purpose. We've touched on this before. We spoke about it in relation to Mikel Arteta and about Gareth Southgate. You have a manager. The old school of management was you bring in someone who's a figurehead, who's a leader, who becomes a sort of Pied Piper and is supposed to lead a way towards something. Whereas with someone like Farker, you're there as an extension of everything that exists at the club. And that includes someone like Weber. That includes the recruiting dynamic. And the result is a tranquility. So, for instance, when one of Norwich's issues this season has been an unwillingness to push all their chips into the middle of the table for the sake of Premier League survival, which is a very smart decision. Now, ordinarily in that situation, if you've got a manager who is a careerist, who is thinking of a path beyond a certain club, that causes a problem. That causes atmosphere, that causes things to leak out into the press. Whereas in this situation, Norwich have kind of, and I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, but they've been very accepting of their fate. They've got on with it. They've played some nice football. They've probably cultivated a few players that will earn them a lot of money in the summer or whenever the window opens, thinking of Cantwell, but probably also Buendia. And the result is harmony. The result is something that looks like it works and something which almost transcends the threat of relegation. And I think that's been the great virtue of their partnership this season.
Yeah.
Who's
impressed you, Aid, in terms of the way Farker has worked tactically with his players? I don't think he's the greatest communicator by any stretch of the imagination. But as a tactician and a coach, how would you assess him?
Very good. And he's got a strong philosophy, clearly. And it's a philosophy that worked amazingly at championship level. That he filled the players with the belief that they could receive the ball anywhere on the pitch and play 1-2 touch through the lines, no matter who they were up against. And it worked. And it led to some thrilling matches. And they flew by the seat of their pants an awful lot on the way to promotion. But it must have been a joy to play for him. Very clear identity. Recruited the right players to fit into that model. My criticism of him, and I completely agree with everything Seb said there, the harmony was the right word, for sure. But I also think that for Daniel himself, it's a slight on his managerial credentials that he's been prepared to stick with it. Because at what stage do your fighting instincts come out? At what stage do you think, you know what, we need to do something different here in order to survive? And I really, really want to survive above all else. It just feels to me that he's been too laid back about that. And for that reason, I think actually his reputation is slightly damaged in some people's eyes. In my eyes, for whatever that's worth, I think it's slightly damaged because I would want my manager, if I was a player for Norwich, great to have the philosophy, but I also want to stay a Premier League player. I want to survive. And I would look as a player and think, shouldn't we be trying to do something a little bit different here to keep things tight?
Well, you know, one manager you couldn't accuse of being laid back is Pep Guardiola. Now, I want to start this by, I'm sure I'll be speaking for both of you as well, to pass on our condolences to him for the loss of his mother due to the coronavirus. Perspective is very painfully gained. And if you look at Guardiola as an individual, he to me embodies how immersive management is and how obsessive you can become within it. He's spoken in the past, Seb, about, you know, the need to have his, you know, his 1 year in New York, the talk about trying to get out of football by the time he's 50. Can you see City being his last club job?
Well, that's a big question. I can, but on the only, not because of him, but on the basis that I can't see where else he'd go at the moment. Bayern Munich, there was always that sense of unfinished business, but that's not going to happen. The political situation back at Barcelona is too prohibitive. He's not going there. Maybe you could make a case for Juventus. Whether there's enough financial primacy in Italian football for that to be realistic, I don't know. Although I'm sure he'd like that notch on his CV, the person to bring the Champions League to Turin. I don't know. I think one thing strikes me with Guardiola in that, say, for instance, he was to, on the old sort of, had coronavirus not happened and the season was finishing in its designated spot, it was coming to an end in the summer. If he were to walk away from Manchester City, then he would have lost a battle, in a sense. He would have been undone by this new, you know, ferocious incendiary brand of football that Jurgen Klopp has preached. And that is very much, he becomes the sort of the beater in the equation from a coaching standpoint. Now, what Guardiola will want to do is, no matter how brilliant he is, he still has an ego. We know this from the press conference we've done with him. He will want to retain that primacy. He will want to be leaving the game, retiring, semi-retiring, at a point where he is at the very, very peak. So his next club or his next move will be instructed by whatever allows him to regain that primacy, if that makes sense. Because it's interesting because almost Klopp's football, what Liverpool are, it's almost a question without an answer at the moment. And it is Guardiola's place to come up with that answer. That is his role. So that's what will instruct what happens next, I think.
Yeah, he'll burn out, won't he? He has to burn out because he's so intense. You can't, I don't think you can live your life for 30, 40 years as a top flight manager the way he does. Or he'll have to change, I guess, his approach. I just think he's a great, one of the game's great innovators tactically. He's always looking to come up with something new, a new tactic, a new nuance within a framework of a shape. I love that about him. I do think he's as close to managerial genius as is out there at the moment, Pep Guardiola. I just think he's phenomenal. But he's got challenges on his hands because his Manchester City team right now is flawed and, you know, they've fallen behind Liverpool and he's got work to do. He's certainly got a lot more work to do in this job. It's just whether he's got that hunger and appetite to do it. This break, by the way, might just might just keep him at Manchester City that little bit longer. I felt compelled that this might be his last year there and that he needed a breather, but we're getting a breather, so to speak, now. So it might actually prolong his stay at the Etihad.
Yeah, I can agree with that, because the one thing that has never dimmed with him is his sense of curiosity, I suppose. You know, I was reading even just this morning, funny enough, about how he'd been influenced by Russian ice hockey and the tactical patterns within that. All coaches are magpies. They take things from here and there. And I suppose that then makes them able to work in any country in any circumstance, which probably leads us into the next manager, Ralf Hasenhüttl at Southampton. It strikes me, Seb, that he's been consistently underrated. Would you agree?
I definitely think so. But I think that's almost, well, not his own fault, but as a result of how his time at Southampton has gone. I actually covered his first game, which was at Cardiff, which was one they lost very narrowly. And you had that initial period of recovery from what he inherited from Mark Hughes, where Southampton did prove immeasurably. And actually, it was quite like sort of, I suppose, seeing someone par a golf course with somebody else's clubs. It worked very, very well. And then obviously at the beginning of this season, it became a whole lot more negative. And so the recovery has been pockmarked by what looked like initial managerial bounce followed by recession. But I think people are starting to wake up to what he's provided now, because Southampton, not only has Southampton become a far better side, but he's also got a much stronger reaction. He's provoked form from players that had really, really dipped at St Mary's and had looked like wasted transfers. Danny Ings is the obvious one. Nathan Redmond, more so last season than this one. Ryan Bertrand has also had a tremendous recovery. You've seen some real improvements in the defence. For a team that conceded 9 goals at home, they really have recovered remarkably well. And I think that speaks exceptionally well vividly to his powers of man management. And how can you not be impressed by that?
Yeah, I get the sense that Southampton is a club which has almost been rebooted. Les Reed, who had a huge overarching influence on the club, has gone to the FA. There does seem to be a sense that Southampton are almost rediscovering themselves.
I think so. Yeah, I really like Ralf Hasenhüttl. I like the cut of his jib right from the word go. I think he lost his way, actually. It can happen where you overcomplicate things in your own mind. And he started to mess around with the shape of the team too much. And what he's done, he's gone back, in a tactical sense, he's gone back to what made him successful with his previous clubs. And that's that box-like 4-2-2-2 formation. And since going back to it, they have absolutely been flying. Yeah, so I think he will have learned lessons through the hard times. Yeah, I've said it before. I was there at Emirates earlier on in the season when they turned the corner, I think, against Arsenal. Sensational performance. They were in bits at the time. It was a 2-2 draw, but it was a 2-2 battering. They were quite brilliant and they maintained it. And unfortunately for them, well, actually, they just tailed off a little bit ahead of this enforced break. So maybe the timing was good for them. But yeah, he's re-energised the team. I think tactically he's good. But for me, he is like Klopp. He's a dynamic personality manager that just fires his players up. They want to run through walls for him. And that, I think, is his greatest quality.
You know, I completely agree. I think his second most eminent quality is probably the tone he sets. When he speaks about his team, when he speaks about his players, when he speaks about results that haven't quite gone Southampton's way, there are no excuses. Now, with all due respect to Mark Hughes is an excuses manager. He's a blame the referee, this wasn't right, the weather was wrong. He was that guy. And I remember the contrast in that first press conference when I can't remember which defender it was that made the mistake that allowed the one goal in that game. But a reporter asked, so sort of, what have you said to, it might have been Jan Bednarek, what have you said to him after the game? And he was like, well, nothing. He's made a mistake. You know, he's got to fix it himself. And I really like accountability. I really like the sort of, I know it's a bit of a simplification. It's kind of a mediaism on my behalf. But I think when you have a manager whose public face is not accusatory, but not accepting of the kind of the soft excuses that play well in the press, I really like that. And I think that's something he's brought as well.
You know what that is? It's confidence. If you're confident in yourself, you can be honest and open and just be like that. When you're doubting yourself, that's when you want to protect yourself and that's when the excuses come out, in my view.
Yeah. Next up, Roy Hodgson, the great elder statesman of English football, but someone who's almost a global figure. Very regimented tactically. He absolutely hates losing. You see him in press conferences and you ask him a question, he can be objectionable. And if you look at him in, out of context, you think, well, what are you doing? But actually, within context, I love that passion for the job. And it's, sometimes, you saw he was basically battered down by the Liverpool job and also by the England job. And I thought that we'd seen pretty much the last of him. But what he's done at Crystal Palace in the last couple of seasons has been fantastic.
What a resilient guy.
Amazing.
Mm. Yeah, just so resilient. Like you say, I mean, it ended disastrously with England. It would have finished off less a man. Yeah, I actually love how moody he gets with journalists. I mean, there's some great videos knocking around, aren't they, of stuff off camera with Roy Hodgson, and yeah, it's just sort of just it makes me feel like I wish I was as much of a bad loser as he is when I'm that age, sort of thing. Age has not mellowed him at all. Look, he's got limitations tactically, for sure, but that man can organise a defence. He can set up a solid shape, and I think what he's doing with Crystal Palace is unreal, really. I think 7 out of 10 managers would have probably been relegated with the Crystal Palace squad that he's got. And the fact that he's kept the trapdoor at arm's length so comfortably is a testament to his organisational skills. And I like the fact as well that he brings in other people to work alongside him that are younger, that are more relatable to the players. Because that is a slight issue, I think, in this day and age. He's a granddad, isn't he, compared to these guys. We talked about Chris Wilder. We were talking on the previous show, Chris Wilder, telling his players about Brian Robson. They'd never heard of him or never saw him play. I mean, Roy Hodgson must seem so ancient to some of those younger players at Palace. Not that there are that many. So I think he's doing a brilliant job in those circumstances too.
Yeah, you talk about bringing younger people in around him. If you brought older people in, it would be like Last of the Summer Wine, wouldn't it? I suppose the one thing that comes across, and perhaps is it, his Italian experiences, he is a training ground coach, isn't he? And that, the element of repetition bores players to death, but it makes them better. You agree with that, Seb?
Yeah, I think so. And I think the results of that are seen in individual performances because he's been able to coach himself around some pretty awful recruitment. If you look at the tools he's been given to do that job, and particularly up front, the lack of a scoring forward, I think, I think it's a measure of Roy Hodgson. He's been able to get such a tune out of Jordan Ayew, like a player that's not really a forward, he doesn't really have a kind of a proper designation on the pitch, not proper position. He's been able to, he's scored goals, important goals all over the place. Okay, not a huge amount in volume, but productivity-wise, he scored all sorts of goals. And I think it's kind of, in a way, it's obviously good for Palace in the short term, but over the long term, I wonder whether Hodgson's management is preventing them from having to ask deeper questions of their football structure. When was the last time, for instance, they made a profit on a player? When was the last time Abe mentioned it in his answer? Like, when was the last time they prospected on a high promise young talent? I know they tried to sign Nathan Ferguson in January, and that fell down due to a medical, and that's presumably going to go ahead as and when the season ends. But their long term trend is to invest in players already at or beyond the peak of their careers, and so you wonder whether he's actually been almost a fig leaf for their broader failings.
Yeah, I think let's sort of truncate this section into maybe one more manager we'll look at, and then we can go back to this in the next episode. The final one today to look at is Eddie Howe at Bournemouth. We know the backstory, the way that, in essence, he saved the club, went away to Burnley, but was soon back with Bournemouth. smallest ground in the Premier League. Some talk that they will be really financially affected by what's going on. So, is he at the crossroads of his career?
I would say he's probably a little bit beyond the crossroads of his career. I think there, for a manager like him, there's such a thing as an ideal leaving point. When you're promising and you're still not the fully realised, you know, the full article, people are much more forgiving of the things that you don't do so well. So for Eddie Howe, Bournemouth have always had that asterisk against their defence, that inability to keep clean sheets at the top level. And up until probably about 6 months ago, that wasn't attributed to Eddie Howe himself. It was kind of one of those things that was filed away with his naiveties. I worry about what would happen to them were they to go down, but also to him, because I think the conversation has changed around him. I think instead of being connected with clubs like Arsenal and Everton, I think people are starting to, fairly or otherwise, notice the things that don't go so well under him. Some of the recruitment isn't terrific. I know it's not necessarily his department, but Tyro Mings' comments about injuries at Bournemouth tallied with what's happened to someone like David Brooks and Lloyd Kelly, it's not that flattering. So I think there are questions to answer. I don't think by any means that he deserves to be shunted off back to the Football League. I just think that there his next move has become incredibly important, and it's not his trajectory isn't necessarily as vertical as it once would have been.
Where do you see him ending up,
It's a good question. I agree. I think he probably should have moved on before now. In a way, it might be best for his career to try and rejuvenate Bournemouth and become that dynasty manager. I guess he already is a dynasty coach there. He's been there so long. Yeah, I'm conflicted really on Eddie Howe, because I've got great admiration for him. He's younger than me. He's achieved so much. The style of football has always been pretty pleasing on the eye. But a little bit like Daniel Farke, has he been rounded enough in his approach? Has he seen the bigger picture tactically? And I would definitely say that he hasn't. He has ignored defensive organisation, or it at least appears that way. I think that the recruitment has been questionable down the years as well. So Eddie Howe, definitely at a crossroads. I don't see him ending up at an Arsenal. I don't see him ending up. I could see him previously. I thought Everton might go for him. That ship sailed, of course. So no, I think a sideways move. He could probably get a slightly bigger club in the Premier League, or a top club in the Championship. I think there is a ceiling, unfortunately, for Eddie.
Yeah. Well, scores on the doors time for those five. Anyway, don't mind kicking it off. I would give Eddie Howe and Daniel Farke 6, Ralph Hasenhüttl 7, Roy Hodgson 8, just for the body of work that he's done.
Yeah, yeah.
And Pep Guardiola 9. I wouldn't give him 10. He's brilliant as a leader, tactician, and as a coach. He can communicate with his players, but does he communicate with the wider world? I think that's an area where he lets himself down. So only 9 out of 10. What do you think?
you're a tough taskmaster, but I agree. I do think that's the one flaw. He's so prickly, isn't he, in presses at times. And I do think that he has ignored certain flaws in Manchester City in recent times. There's an element of stubbornness there. I'd definitely give him a 9, though, for his body of work. And like I say, I think he's genius. I would probably go for Hasenhüttl as a 7.5. I just think he's destined for bigger things, Ralph Hasenhüttl. I can see him get a bigger job. Might not be in the Premier League, but a bigger job maybe across the continent. Roy Hodgson, a very, very solid 7. Eddie Howe, 6.5. Excellent, but I do think maybe he's peaked. And we all peak at different times. And I think he's gone a bit stale, really, in his tenure at Bournemouth. And Daniel Farke, I'll give a 6. Purely on the basis that I'm not sure that he's adapted as well as I'd anticipated in the Premier League.
So, Seb, who are you going to upset?
I tell you what, I'm not going to quibble with any of you except with Farke, because I think I agree with Adrian's point earlier about how you sometimes it's necessary to agitate for more. But I think that a lot of football clubs look at how head coaches fit into their structure and what kind of disruption they potentially cause. And
I think if you look at the things that he's had to cope with, for instance, the sale of James Maddison with a revenue, I think their Norwich's record transfer is still Grant Hanley. I think I might be wrong about that. But he's had to cope with an awful lot of flux, and he's done it with a company face, with without sort of pointing fingers at people. And I think that sort of the tranquil politics aspect of football club life is becoming increasingly important. So I'm going to bump him up to a 7, maybe even a 7.5. But yeah, you know what? Agreed on that Guardiola point, because it's amazing how prickly he is. It's not even, it's almost conspiratorial at times. There's always a referee. He's almost evolving into second act Jose Mourinho month by month. It's absolutely amazing for someone that is fawned over as much as he has been, and it has been the kind of the hero character of so many different articles. He really doesn't tolerate criticism in any way whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll stay with you, Sam, if we may. Tournament focus. As you know, we do it every episode. We pick out a tournament. Which one do you want to do this week?
Okay, so I'm going back to 2006 and the World Cup in Germany. This is where I upset people. You were asked before. This is where I'm going to do it, because the tournament itself is, as a spectacle, fine. But I chose it because of how I felt and how I started to react to the England team during it. I think this is the point in my life where a significant fracture occurred between the way I'd responded to England playing in previous tournaments, the kind of the nervousness, the attachment, the investment that you had, and then this sort of outburst of celebrity culture which consumed the England team. That was the tournament when Sven-Goran Eriksson allowed wives and girlfriends and family members around, and we had this kind of ongoing pantomime day-to-day in the tabloids with, you know, which wife was buying what and, you know, who was wearing what sunglasses in the stands, which I think was very unfair on some of those people. Very unfair on the players. I think very unfair on the players' families. I think it was a level of scrutiny which I found pretty uncomfortable. But mixed in with that was Sven-Goran Eriksson, who I still haven't really forgiven, I don't think, for how he made me feel about the England team. Because before the last World Cup, I read a quote from Jermaine Genus, I think. And I think he was writing in The Guardian, and he said he remembered at different points in the tournament that he would sit on the substitutes bench and he would watch what we would, which was a misfiring, underperforming England. And he would say to whoever he was sitting next to, probably Michael Carrick or whoever else, Phil Neville perhaps, it doesn't matter, because no matter how bad the performance is, he's not going to drop any of these players. And I just thought, yeah, that actually summarized how I felt about it, because watching, I'm not sure I could distinguish from one England performance to the next. It was always the same. It always had the same inefficiencies, always quite good in the first half, always less good in the second half, always the same players failing in the same ways. And that, I think, that started a trend of the public detaching from England for quite a long time. And I think it also feeds into what a good job Gareth Southgate has done, because he's closed that gap. He has brought that personality and that affection back towards the England side, which is a very precious commodity. But that is is what 2006 reminds me of, definitely.
Yeah, I get that, because I suppose the nature of England's departure from the tournament was, you know, pretty revealing in terms of, okay, another loss on penalties to Portugal in the quarterfinals, but also Wayne Rooney being sent off in that game for the stamp on Carvalho. You know, the famous Ronaldo wind-up wink. And I thought also, you know, I thought there was an element of vacuity to Eriksson. But he did come out with one great quote after that game where he talked about Rooney and said, "Don't kill him because you need him." That was a high watermark for Rooney in one way, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. He was just raw and, yeah. It was just one of those things. He learned from it, and like, he's developed into a very mature sort of older player now, hasn't he, Wayne Rooney? But yeah, it was hard to take at the time. But no, I'd echo all the views. I was never a fan of Sven-Goran Eriksson, and yeah, that England team. Yeah, like you say, it was all about the favourites. It was all about wag status, wasn't it? Who, you know, the most famous players and famous wives were all that seemed to matter in that tournament. From an England perspective, it was, yeah, they never stood a chance of winning it. Yeah, I thought it was my view of the tournament was that the group stage was amazing. There were so many great games, so many goals, and then it kind of fizzled out a bit. Once things got serious, the games got worse, really, in my view, which I think was a crying shame. Obviously, the thing to remember is the Zidane headbutt in the final. Yeah. I mean, just like that is what that World Cup. That was just the complete jaw dropping moment, wasn't it? It was like, what?
Yeah,
I have to rewind it. What actually happened? He didn't do that, did he? He didn't really do it. It was absolutely bonkers, and for that to be sort of the way he bowed out was sad, I think, but also very Zidane. But one moment that really gets overlooked is Pirlo's performance in that final. Just sublime. And I think he took the first pen of the shootout and he dinked, he Panenka'd it. And I just thought, whoa, World Cup final, penalty shootout, you're first up. To have the nerve to do that, I just thought, this man's not human. That is too cool. too cool for school. So yeah, for me, that was a real highlight.
Yeah. So while we've got you in this philosophical mood, Aid, can you lead us off? Thought for the day, please.
Right. Thought for the day. I'm changing tact on what we've just been discussing. Going back, actually, to something we discussed on the previous episode, and that is regarding the PFA. It feels to me, with the Players Together group, the band of brothers that formed this union, really, I think is the best way to describe it, to come up with a charity venture for the NHS. I'm just so impressed by it, by the speed of it, by the organisation, by the cohesion of it. And it's just planted that seed in my head, a little thought for the day. Are we heading towards a breakaway new union formed by the players for the players? Gordon Taylor's review, independent review, began 2 years ago, was it? No real progress.
13
as far
months,
as we know.
I think. Yeah.
Yeah, 30. Yeah, so over a year. The salary is just ridiculous. And I feel that he is out of touch with the needs of the modern player. And for that reason, and the fact that they've gone and organised so brilliantly this charity, I believe they can also go and organise their own union and set it up in time. I'm not saying it will happen, but I think that there is a possibility that this might be the beginning of the end of the PFA as we know it.
All up for grabs. Seb, what's yours?
Wow, that's quite taking my breath away. Well, I was wondering whether, because we've got this enforced pause, I'm wondering whether now is the time possibly to have a think about how we structure the game and the physical conditions we're enforcing on players. We're all football fans. We're here because in the beginning we wanted to watch the game. And I think we're moving towards a point at which, because of the volume of fixtures and because of the lack of break built into the calendar, we're risking a situation where a player's prime is probably over by the time he gets to 27, 28 years old. You know, particularly at the top of the game where, you know, they're traveling across time zones 3-4 times a year. They've got an international tournament in the summer. They have probably 3 weeks off a year, which is just not enough. I don't want a situation in football where we are killing a golden goose, where we are denied potentially a player's finest years and, you know, the brightest point of his spectacle. I think it's really, really important to recognise where we're headed. And because at the moment the calendar is in flux and because concessions are going to have to be made, I think now is really the perfect opportunity to think about that properly, to not just get swept along with what's happened before and to be led by precedent, to actually think, is this the game and is this the texture of game that we want going forward? And I would say no.
Well, we've spoken a lot on this episode about managers, and these are strange times for football managers. They're used to a highly pressurised job. They've made their plans. They've assigned their staff to small groups of their players. And now what? Well, they have to sit at home and wait. At least club managers have the prospect of a return. But what about someone like Gareth Southgate? Who knows when England will play again? International football has never felt so distant. You have to wonder whether this will push him back into club football and perhaps the Premier League. Thanks for joining us on the Football Writers Podcast, and stay safe out there.
Hi,
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.